Okay. So I'm going to talk about work I've done mostly with Peter Arnold, but also earlier on with Jonathan Linehan and Larry Yaffe, who then had better give me extra time, I suppose. And a number of other people have worked on this, so there's. So the general picture is when we collide two nuclei together, you should think of them as flat pancakes because of Lorentz contraction. But they're flat pancakes made out of a whole bunch of individual quarks and gluons, which leave behind a region of quarks and gluons, which was described earlier as an almond shape, but it's really an almond sliver. It's flat. And just as V2 was generated because it was narrower in this direction than it is in the longitudinal direction, the fact that it's very thin also means that you're going to develop large anisotropies if the coupling is weak and scatterings are inefficient. You'll develop large anisotropies of how the particles are flying around in there. So if you start out in a region that's shaped like this, then since the particles embedded in this region are flying at the speed of light, at some time later they will have puffed up into this wider region here. For a particle to remain in the central region after the thing is puffed up, it must have been moving transversely, because if it was moving with a large forward or backward component, it would simply have ended up in the forward or backward regions instead of remaining in the middle region. So just if things just fly in straight lines, then the fact that you started out with something long and skinny means that after it puffs up, in the middle you'll have things which are flying primarily in the plane of the original scattering. An analog of this situation, interesting things happen when this occurs, when you have a highly anisotropic distribution of particles flying around and they have some kind of gauge charge. The simplest example to sort of get a flavor for what kind of things can happen when that occurs are to have two interpenetrating plasmas. And for the moment, I'll just pretend that they're electromagnetic, so they're made out of little pluses denoted in blue and minuses denoted in red. And when they crash into each other, then you have a region where you have a plasma, except that all the particles are moving in this horizontal region instead of having a random distribution of directions. And if you have that, and you happen to have a small magnetic field, a little seed magnetic field, with a magnetic field at right angles to the dominant direction of motion, and a K vector also at right angles to the dominant direction of motion, then the particles deflect in an interesting way. A positive charge flying in this direction has a V cross B force, which says that it should get pushed down. The ones flying here get pushed up, and that focuses them into this region between magnetic field sheets. Well, they get defocused from here. The guys flying in the opposite direction are focused into here and defocused in there. That doesn't cause any net charge. Neither does the focusing and defocusing of the opposite charge of species. But in every one of these cases, for the guys flying this direction and this direction, positive and negative charge, you generate a net current. These guys have a net current pointing this way between these sheets and pointing that way between these sheets. And you then pull out your right hand and apply the right-hand rule to determine what magnetic field those generate. This says it'll generate a magnetic field out of the board, into the board. This one generates into the board, out of the board, which is precisely the seed magnetic field. So if all of these guys just have, each individually have a small deflection, but there are lots and lots of them, you let them fly long enough, this current will become large enough, they'll generate a magnetic field bigger than the one that you started with. The magnetic field strength then doubles, and that doubles the disturbance of these trajectories, that doubles the magnetic field strength. This is an exponential instability. It's an exponential instability that arises because of some collective effect. Each one of these charges only has to deflect by a very small angle. But the fact that there are lots and lots of them collectively doing that is sufficient to lead to this instability. And this is called the Weibull instability, and the plasma physicists have known about it since the 50s. Note, if I had had an isotropic distribution of particles, then the guys which are flying at right angles to that previous dominant direction, say along this beam direction, wiggle back and forth in this magnetic field in a way that actually turns out to create a net current that opposes the one I just described. And there's a simple argument using rotational engage invariance that if you average, if you take an isotropic plasma, so there are guys flying in every direction, and you average over all the directions that particles can fly, these currents all average to zero. An easy way to see that that's true is that this magnetic field here bends particles, so the particles moving this way bend up, and particles moving the opposite way bend down. But anyway, a magnetic field just takes an isotropic distribution of particle momenta and it rotates it into the same isotropic distribution of particle momenta. So if you have an isotropic distribution, there's no disturbance. Okay. The neat thing that that means is that if you have any departure from an isotropic distribution, there will always be some magnetic field orientation and polarization in K-vector, which is unstable, always. So any departure from equilibrium automatically gives you a plasma instability. There are other plasma, there's another way of thinking about this in terms of wires. You can take the particles with plus charges going that way, minus charges going that way, and think of them as a wire. And you can take the ones of the opposite and think of it as a wire pointing the other direction. And so what you started out with was just a scramble of wires interpenetrating. And then there's this funny thing when you calculate the magnetic interaction between two wires. Parallel wires carrying the same current actually attract each other. And so if you have a mess of wires, but they're all pointing east-west, then since parallel wires attract, if you sort of cut a plane across that and think of it as a whole bunch of little dots, and you say the like dots attract each other and the unlike dots repel each other, you know that's an unstable situation. Those things will tend to clump up. And that's another way of understanding this instability. Now, skip the fact that there are other instabilities. And you all know that there's no actual problem with thermodynamics. It sounds strange that I have the spontaneous generation of these long wavelength coherent fields. But that's okay because I started out with a situation with a lot of free energy because I was only using some fraction of the phase space of available directions to have particles fly in. There's no contradiction to thermodynamics. There is, however, a hidden assumption in everything that I've said so far, which is that I've assumed that I have weak coupling. The reason I've assumed, or some ways to see that I've assumed that, is I've secretly made a classical field approximation in describing those magnetic fields. I said, supposing I have a magnetic field, a charge flies through it, it bends. That's a completely classical picture. I can get away with assuming that long wavelength fields are classical if I'm willing to make an approximation that a gauge coupling is weak, because that lets me talk about high occupancy fields, which are classical. And high occupancy is something that makes sense if the coupling is weak, because I can have an occupancy as large as 1 over alpha before I encounter some kind of a fundamental... Well, in QCD, I can have a occupancy as large as 1 over alpha before I get into trouble and I have to start worrying about nonlinearities. Well, the notion of occupancy here has in it a notion of K. And thinking that you can split things up into momenta is a gauge choice dependent question. And when you start having strong fields, then gauge choices start really mattering and become completely ambiguous. So the notion of even separating things into long and short wavelength when they're gauge charged is ambiguous if you have large fields. Okay. I also used a classical particle picture for the high K degrees of freedom. And that you can get away with as long as there's a separation of scales between the Dubois wavelength of the high energy guys and the coherence length of the inverse wavelength of the, sorry, inverse wave number of the classical fields. And such a separation of scale also turns out to require that you're at weak coupling for it to make sense. So another way of seeing, for instance, this classical particle picture require strong coupling is just to think, well, what would happen if I had a dense gas of quasi-particles and I were at strong coupling? The answer is that they would scatter with each other so frequently that you couldn't think that they were even quasi-particles anymore. If you fly one Dubois wavelength between scatterings, then it doesn't make sense to even think that you're a quasiparticle. So the whole description in terms of quasiparticles doesn't make sense. Well, I can get away from that by just having a dilute gas of quasiparticles. I just have a few of them with a lot of momentum, and then their mean separation is enough that I can talk about them as quasiparticles, except that if you're at strong coupling, you can't do that either, because the notion of a particle at strong coupling doesn't make sense either. They fragment, and then you immediately cease to be dilute. And the only thing that can keep you from fragmenting for long enough for things to fly reasonable distances is that alpha is strong, because the splitting rates all involve factors of alpha. So you really have to be at weak coupling. And weak coupling in QCD is probably not a realistic assumption if you're going to talk about energy scales that can be achieved in heavy ion collisions that we're likely to see any time in our lifespan. But I don't care. I'm a theorist, and so I'm just going to try to understand what would happen if you were at weak coupling. And so for the remainder of this talk, you just have to accept there's a chance that this has something to do with heavy ion collisions, but it's not absolutely clear, because the coupling probably isn't weak enough. And hopefully, at some point, if we can get quantitative, we can come back and try to address how large or small of G is actually weak. But unfortunately, well, as I'll discuss, it's a little sticky to try to get to squeeze hard numbers out of this business. But first, let's see what these plasma instabilities do and how they're different in QCD. So the big difference between the plasma instabilities in QED, which I described, and QCD are that in your Ampere law, you get an extra term from the non-abelian nature of the gauge field. So this is really d mu f mu nu, and the d is the del plus a term involving a commutator of the gauge field with the field strength. And furthermore, this current, which is described by a bunch of particles and their charges, those particles also color rotate as they fly along. The charge of a particle gets parallel transported along its trajectory, and so it changes over time. You also have the issue that you're actually eight copies of electromagnetism. But if you are at weak coupling, which in this case means the product of, if you're at weak field, which in this case means G times the size of your gauge field is small, then both this color rotation and the nonlinear terms in the Yang-Mills equation are negligible, and the behavior should be the same as it was in QED, in which case we know that you're going to have these instabilities occur. This cannot be small at strong coupling, because quantum fluctuations already tell you sort of the expectation value of A squared is order one. And so what is my what? No, I'm saying that if I want the equations I've just described to approximately look like the QED equations, then it's necessary, because that allows me to drop these extra terms. Now, what I'm going to do is not drop these extra terms and see what happens when it isn't small. Okay, so for you to be guaranteed that these plasma instabilities will be there and will grow exponentially, you have to have not only small g, but you also have your gauge fields be in modest size. And you expect over time, since they're growing exponentially, that they'll get large, and then you'll need these extra terms. And so to understand what's really going to happen in QCD, you're going to be forced to discuss strongly nonlinear set of equations. Okay. And this is just a statement that if you let me get away with assuming that coupling is small, then in a heavy ion collision, you're basically guaranteed that these instabilities are going to occur, because you'll definitely get a plasma of quarks and gluons. I just argued, if you let me assume that the coupling is small, which should be valid in the limit of arbitrarily high energy, the plasma automatically becomes anisotropic, because it always starts out extremely flat, and higher energies it actually starts out thinner and thinner. And so its expansion is more and more certain to give you anisotropy. And maybe the gauge field won't start out big, but what we're really going to be interested in is what happens after the gauge field becomes large, these sort of field-saturated plasma instabilities. So how on earth am I going to figure out how those behave? Well, I'm going to write down a set of equations, which are basically what you get by making the assumptions that I described earlier, namely that your coupling is weak, and so you can describe things in terms of classical fields and classical particles. And then the classical particles you treat with kinetic theory, and the classical fields you treat with classical field equations in the background, or as which act as background fields for the kinetic degrees of freedom. So it's a Vlasov type equations. And typically we make one additional approximation, which is that the particles are close to color neutral. So the disturbance of the distribution function to have more red and less anti-red, say, is small compared to the total number of red plus anti-red particles. And if you make that approximation, then you can simplify the equations a little bit and write them in terms of a field I'll call W of X and V, which is just the number, the net coloration of particles at point X moving in the direction V. And where W comes from is that every time you have an electric or a magnetic field, then that will take the colorless distribution of particles you had lying around, and it will distort it. The electric field will accelerate one color against the other. The magnetic field will rotate one color against the other, which, if you have an anisotropic distribution, drives you from equilibrium. And then you'll have a net coloration at that point in space. And then that net coloration propagates. The particles fly in a straight line. And so at each point in space, you're going to get sort of a coloration. This says that you'll get a coloration described by a line integral over the past places particles got to that point from, of the fields which disturbed the plasma along that backwards line, parallel transported with the appropriate Wilson line, which is just that color rotation I mentioned earlier. And then I should take this net coloration and I should feed it as a current into my Yang-Mills equations, and then I should simultaneously solve these two things. And then you implement it on the lattice, and I think the less you say about that, the better. And now I'm going to try to describe what happens in three cases, sort of generically what happens, just to get sort of a handle on what the physics looks like. And then what happens if the anisotropy is large, which should occur early in heavy ion collisions, and what happens if it's small, which should be relevant near but not super near equilibrium, and I'll explain what I mean by that a little bit more. So generically, what's going to happen, if the field starts out very small, and I've argued that we know it's going to behave like the electromagnetic case where it grows exponentially, so it won't be very small for very long. And it turns out the time scale for it to grow is always faster than the age of a system, which would be that far out of isotropy. And so this is never actually the relevant situation. What's important is what happens after it becomes large. It turns out what happens is that the amount of energy in the electromagnetic field grows linearly, not exponentially, but linearly. And you can figure out what that means by finding a gauge invariant way of separating how much of that energy is associated with long, medium long, relatively short wavelengths. And when you do that, you find out that the amount that's associated with infrared, really long wavelength things, is actually Well, I shouldn't say it's staying the same. It's bouncing around, but it's staying the same in average. So energy is going into them from the instability, and it's going out of them again by some other means. And that energy which is going out of them is going into reasonably infrared things, and the energy is leaving them and going into less infrared things. So it appears that what's happening is that you have, because of the plasma instability, you're stealing energy from the hard modes and dumping them into these long wavelength magnetic fields. But then they have non-abelian interactions with each other, which are chaotic. And if you put a lot of energy into long wavelengths, then that's not the right equilibrium description. You should try to equipartition that energy into shorter and shorter wavelengths. And so there will be a cascade of this energy towards shorter wavelengths. And that's what we just saw. And we can see that by gauge invariant but clumsy measurables, and we can also see it by gauge-dependent Coulomb gauge spectra, where you see that in the infrared here you have some large occupancies, and then as a function of time, each of these is at a later time slice, the energy progressively goes into higher and higher wave numbers. This stuff stays self-similar, and the energy cascades up to higher and higher wave numbers. So that's sort of the generic behavior that you expect from these things. Now, I could try. I don't know how much it would mean. Coulomb gauge is a useful way of describing things where they're not strongly coupled. So where this number is below, you know, 1 or 0.5 or something here, I can sort of believe that this is describing how things are varying as a function of physical length. In here, it's probably describing how badly Coulomb gauge flails around trying to figure out what these fields mean. So I don't know how much this part. Yeah, probably. That's right. You get a contribution of zero momentum from that, from all wavelengths. Thanks. I used to know that. Okay. So what happens if you talk about a system which is strongly anisotropic? Say where all the particles fly in a small, within a small angle theta of being in that plane that I would expect them to get into if I expand a system by an arbitrary amount. Well, there are lots of questions you can ask about that system. What's unstable and what isn't? How fast does it grow? How large does it grow before this cascade occurs? What good does it do? And in order to ask these questions, remember that what we're talking about is a collective effect. I have lots and lots of individual particles, each deflecting by a small amount to cause this instability. And there's one characteristic scale in describing that collective effect, which is a scale M, the so-called thermal mass. It's roughly it would be the Debye scale in an isotropic system. And we think of this as a length scale, the scale on which screening occurs. But it's really better to think of it as a time scale. It's the time scale for currents to develop enough to cause back reaction on the electromagnetic field. So supposing it has a wave vector k and an amplitude, which I will call b, but b will turn out to drop out from what I want to describe. And my question is, this is going to deflect particles. How long does it take for the deflection of that particle to create enough current to really matter? Matter in the sense that the covariant derivative of B term in the Yang-Mills equation, this current grows to be as big as that, so that the Yang-Mills equation is no longer behaving like a free equation, but is significantly modified by what these charges are up to. Because that's what's going to determine how fast this magnetic field is going to be growing. The current, which grows up big enough that it compete with this term and force the magnetic fields to grow exponentially. And to answer that, you say, well, as this guy flies along in this magnetic field, it's going to deflect. The magnetic field will bend it. The bending angle is the magnetic field times time divided by momentum. That's just, you know, force time over momentum. And therefore, the deflection distance is the angle times the amount of time. The current is something like the deflection distance divided by this wave length times the total charge density of particles in the plasma. This is sort of how many guys there are to deflect, and then this is how far they deflect compared to the spacing of these magnetic sheets. That's what determines the current. And when I stick in these numbers, I get something which is proportional to the magnetic field, to its k vector, and to this m times t squared. If I say, when is that the same size as the covariant derivative of the magnetic field? It's when mt is order 1, or if you prefer, when you wait long enough that you've waited a time 1 over the scale m. So physically, the scale M is how long do you have to wait for the particles to bend enough that they've induced a current which really back reacts on the fields. Having thought that through, we can now figure out what modes are unstable and how fast they grow. A particle has to remain coherently in the same sign of magnetic field for this length of time for a current to develop big enough that it's going to do anything. It will not remain coherently in the same sign of magnetic field if the magnetic field varies too quickly in the plane on which the particles are running. That happens any time the transverse component of its wave vector is bigger than the scale M. It also won't remain coherently in the same sign magnetic field if the angular spread of the particles is too big compared to the inverse wave vector, the wavelength of the magnetic field. And that turns out to require that the Z component of the wave vector be greater than, or be smaller than M over this theta, this spreading angle. So if you have a very narrow spreading angle, then even if the magnetic field is varying rapidly in the Z direction, since the particles aren't moving in the Z direction, they'll still stay in a coherent region of magnetic field for a long time. So the magnetic fields which are unstable are the ones with a Z component, which is M over theta, and a perpendicular component less than M. So it's an anisotropic set of Ks which are unstable. So the typical generic magnetic field which should grow should look something like this. It's almost but not quite only varying in this direction, and it has every sign of color that you could want. Okay, and those guys will grow either until color randomization takes a length of 1 over m, in which case you'll coherently build up a current, but then the current will switch color and won't actually reinforce the magnetic field that generated it. Or it'll occur when non-abelian interactions become important between the different gauge fields. And if you make an estimate of how large each one of these things, how large the field has to be for each of these things to happen, you get the same estimate in each case. And the reason is because you can just change gauge to force the colors not to randomize, but that just puts the damage into one of these other guys. So the separation between which of these things cuts off the instability is probably not gauge invariant. But they all give the same estimate for how large the field should grow. And when you stick that estimate into determining how big the magnetic field is, the magnetic field gets an extra inverse power of the angular spread and how big it grows. And therefore, the strength of the cascade that I described earlier will be larger by a factor of 1 over theta squared. And when we tried to do this with some range of degrees of anisotropy, this here is basically this angle theta, and this is how fast the energy is growing, already assuming the form that I just described. And we see that you have a valid intercept if you go to small angles. So the description I just gave is supported by calculations. So we have some kind of a handle over what happens at large anisotropies, although I'd still like to extract actual numbers from this, which we could use for what happens to the hard particles and how quickly do they isotropize. It's also amusing to try to figure out what happens when you have something that's close to equilibrium, where the what happens if you, say, had a shear flow del V, which is relatively small, so the departure from equilibrium shouldn't be so big. Do plasma instabilities matter at all in that case? Or what range of these do they matter? Well, near equilibrium means that I can take my distribution function to be close to the equilibrium one and worry about this little departure, delta F. And delta F is sourced by the fact that I have an anisotropic distribution of particles, basically because they fly from where they are to somewhere else where the velocity is supposed to be different, there's a generated departure from equilibrium proportional to the momenta of the particle times this derivative of the velocity field. Now, this departure from equilibrium is going to generate plasma instabilities. And then that plasma instability is going to restore equilibrium. But collisions are also going to restore equilibrium. So there's a contest between how fast equilibrium is restored by collisions and by the plasma instabilities induced by this departure from equilibrium. So we know how to figure out the part with collisions, so let's try to see if we can understand how to do the part from plasma instability. Well, I'm assuming weak anisotropy, so my delta F is small compared to my F, and that means that there's only some small subset of the particles which are inducing these plasma instabilities. That turns out to mean that the unstable wave number squared is suppressed by one power of how small this departure from equilibrium is. Long wavelengths, degrees of freedom in a plasma, evolve very slowly because of Landau damping. So the time scale for those guys to evolve turns out to be suppressed by an extra factor of delta F over F. So you're going to have very slowly growing plasma instabilities in this regime. And very slowly growing means the magnetic field will dominate the electric field. And so they're going to be almost purely magnetic. It also turns out to mean that this cascade that I described earlier is absent in the case of this weak anisotropy. And essentially the reason is because you have gauge fields on this wavelength non-abelianly interacting with each other, sort of scattering from each other to induce gauge fields on this wavelength. These guys are not unstable. They ought to just propagate, but propagating for something of this wavelength, it's still longer than the Bi scale. And so propagation means just Landau damping away. So the picture that I had earlier of what happened here, you would have soft unstable modes, and then their non-abelian interaction dumps energy up a little higher. But these are degrees of freedom which are Landau damped, and so the energy would just disappear from there again. So the cascade is absent in this case. Okay. The size of these magnetic fields saturates when their non-abelian interactions with each other become important. And from that size of the magnetic field, which was on the previous overhead here, so the size of the magnetic field should still be the wave number squared. From that you can estimate how much they bend the trajectories of particles. So they give you a mean squared momentum change per unit time given by the square of the magnetic field, because the magnetic field gives you the momentum bending rate, times the coherence length of the magnetic field. And that's this instability scale cubed, which is the 3/2 power of my departure from equilibrium. So the rate at which my extra out-of-equilibrium guys bend is suppressed by an extra 3/2 power of the departure from equilibrium. So my rate of approach to equilibrium has this very bizarre 5/2 power dependence on the departure from equilibrium. That means that my departure from equilibrium is going to involve a 2/5 power of the strength of the shear flow. Bizarre prediction. No, in fact, it stopped being important even before then. So then you get a prediction that... Oh, sorry, there's one thing. You also have to compare this rate of equilibration, this departure from equilibrium, to what you would get just from ordinary old scatterings. An ordinary old scattering say that delta F should decay with the time scale given by delta F to the first power, not 5/2, divided by G to the fourth. So then you have to compare those where the scatterings are more important, then you get one behavior, where they're less important, you get the other. So you get a prediction that the departure from equilibrium should be, that whenever the departure from equilibrium is smaller than the one you would guess from scattering, what's the right way of saying this? When scattering, okay, so at very small shear flow, scattering dominates the approach to equilibrium, and you would get a linear rise in the stress tensor as a function of shear flow. The stress tensor is proportional to this delta F. But then after it gets up high enough that delta F is big enough that these plasma instabilities start to win, then it should turn over. And it should turn over in this very funny way that it should behave as the 2/5 power. The stress tensor should behave as the 2/5 power of the shear flow. And that should be valid parametrically when the shear flow is in the range from g cubed to g to the 14 thirds times t. So in this funny parametric window, Poisson instabilities should be relevant for determining equilibration, and yet should still be in a regime where you'll remain close to equilibrium so that talking about such things even makes sense. Now, people always ask me, well, what should happen in n equals 4 super Young Mills? And so all of my previous arguments relied on the fact that they have gauge fields, but they didn't depend very in any detailed way on what the matter content was. And so I expect that plasma instability should still be present in n equals 4 super Young Mills at weak coupling, meaning small puffed coupling. Also, all of my arguments, I believe, basically could arise at the planar diagram level. And planar, so the fact that, so when you say, well, is it g squared or g squared nc which should be relevant? It's g squared nc which should be relevant. Okay. Hard thermal loops, for instance, are proportional to g squared nc. Okay. So I believe that at weak coupling, meaning small Tuft coupling, in n equals 4 super Young Mills, there should also be plasma instabilities, and they should dominate the physics of equilibration, except for very close to equilibrium systems. What happens at strong coupling? Well, that's another question. It's not obvious that they should be relevant at strong coupling at all. How would you even figure out if there's relevant at strong coupling? I need to find some gauge invariant measurables that I can grab hold of and say, aha, this proves that plasma instabilities are occurring. But that's not easy, because the magnetic fields that are growing to be big are non-abelian magnetic fields, and the magnetic field strength itself is not directly a valid gauge invariant observable. Yeah, but you need really a large Wilson loop. And Wilson loops, especially, Wilson, yeah. Yeah, putting n equals 4 super Young Mills on the lattice is another question that I don't want to address today. Yeah. Non-equilibrium real-time dynamics? Strong coupling in a... But the classical approximation makes sense because I was at weak coupling. So understanding the dynamics in a self-consistent way at strong coupling isn't obvious. Yeah, what guarantees me that that's a... But what guarantees me that that's a valid condition? Well, you have a project for this coming year. So, I mean, the right approach is that I should find some gauge invariant measurables, which I can say something, they should behave this way, they should do that. And then, you know, then you can go and see whether they behave the way I expect. One thing is this behavior of the stress tensor as a function of del I dj, that it should have this funny bending over here, which involves a 2/5 power. Another is, oh, for instance, either Plackett variables or what I preferred, smeared field operator expectation values. And maybe features of Wilson lines is essentially what you were saying. So this smeared field operator is just a statement that if I take, oh, so first the behavior of Tij. So, why is that 5 half? I think this is wrong. What I wanted to say is that if I have something which is supposed to bend over here and it behaves as the 2/5 power, then that tells you you're necessarily going to have a non-analyticity in the... Is that true either? No, forget it. Always think things out before you write talks. The smeared field operator, yeah, the smeared field operator idea is the following. I can separate unambiguously the infrared stuff from the ultraviolet stuff at weak or strong coupling by defining a smeared gauge field, which is the one you get by starting out with your normal gauge field and then applying this purely dissipative dynamics to it. fake dissipative dynamics. You can either think of this as a way of smearing your fields and then you do measurements on your fields, or you can take a measurement using these things and you can think of it as a smeared operator. The field is the ordinary operator, was a field it was supposed to be, but your operator involves the smearing process on the field. And it gives you a way of, say, extracting the part of the magnetic field which is arising from long wavelength things, which is gauge invariant. And then, if for instance I have Bjorken flow, which gives me this this expected behavior of a planar anisotropy, then if plasma instabilities are present, then I expect that when I get, if I start at large K, so I'm examining the fact that I have a planar flow, sorry, I have a oblate distribution of hard particles, then I expect a larger parallel component of the magnetic field because they're transverse gauge bosons. If they're moving in the plane, then half of them have their B pointing out of the plane instead of the usual one-third. But when I go to small K, then I should be mostly seeing the plasma instability fields, and they should predominantly have transverse components of their magnetic fields. Those are the ones that are unstable. So I should see a dependence on this tau, a switchover from being primarily parallel to being primarily transverse component of my magnetic field. So that would be a gauge invariant prediction at any coupling of what you ought to see if there are plasma instabilities. So in conclusion, plasma instabilities are a generic prediction of Yang-Mills theory if you have weak coupling and you have anisotropic flow. They scale differently depending on the degree of anisotropy. For strong anisotropy, the magnetic field grows as the inverse power of the angular spread. While for weak anisotropy, the magnetic field... the magnetic field squared falls away as the square of how weakly you're anisotropic. And the rate of momentum diffusion then is a 3/2 power of the degree of anisotropy. Plasma instabilities should be present in A=4 super Yang-Mills at weak coupling. And at strong coupling in either theory, it's not clear that they're well defined, but there may be some gauge invariant ways of looking to see if you can find things which look like traces of such plasma instabilities. Okay, and that's I guess what I wanted to say. Rory? Right. Well, okay, so you could say that this is precisely a plot of the zero momentum F squared correlation function. Okay. One of the things that slowed us down is we can only try to see what's going on with these plasma instabilities by looking at gauge invariant operators. And it doesn't sort of immediately give you the degrees of freedom or the description in terms of the set of degrees of freedom that you think are the right way of looking at what's going on. And so that's been sort of an obstacle to our understanding what's going on, even in this case where we think we understand a valid way of simulating the physics. Which people have looked at. But trying to do it entirely using fields turns out to be a severe two-scale problem. And so from a numerical point of view, it's extremely difficult to see the full development of the plasma instabilities in that case. From... Okay, well, we'll discuss them when we see them.
Maybe it's jet lag, but I was confused by something that you said.
So
you said that the growing instabilities dominate the deviations from local equilibrium if the shear velocity stress is sufficiently large and the collisions... No, sorry, the other way around. Yeah. That for small shear velocity stress, say again, which was your...
Okay, if you have a very small shear flow,
yeah,
then since scatterings involve the first power of the departure from equilibrium, and the restoration of equilibrium due to scatterings goes as the first power of the departure from equilibrium. The restoration of equilibrium from the plasma instabilities goes as the 5/2 power. So if you have a very weak departure from equilibrium, then the scatterings win. But the power of G is different in the two. So as the departure from equilibrium becomes larger, that power of G is more important, and the plasma instabilities dominate the approach to equilibrium.
So we know that
for a very small shear flow, for a very small del 1 V2, say, then you're going to have a linear rise here. It's completely determined by ordinary boring scattering. Well, not so boring scattering. And then as you go to larger shear flow, so the departure from equilibrium is bigger, then the 5/2 departure from equilibrium is sort of becoming more important faster and dominates the physics, and the plasma instabilities then dominate the restoration of equilibrium and predict a smaller stress.
Okay, so then this does agree with my intuition, because at the DIVJ is big initially, and then becomes small at later times. So you're saying that the plasma instabilities dominate isotropization at early times, and then the collisions take over at later times.
In a weakly coupled plasma. Yes. Yeah, actually, I didn't bring any of those plots, but we do look at that. And when the plasma instabilities saturate, then you have sort of very rapid diffusion of Chern-Simons number with relatively long coherence for which direction it's changing. So you do generate a lot of topological number. I don't know if it's quasi-particles or not.
There's quite some experience with gauge fixing in QCD and imaginary time. And as far as I understand, apart from Grebov copies problems, it seems to work quite well. Even now, let's say at zero temperature or at high temperature, you still would expect large fields in either case. And I don't see, and it has also been compared to calculation with Schwinger-Dyson equations and so on. All these pictures you get from gauge fixing, say you do the computations without gauge fixing, and then you do gauge fixing, as you know very well.
Yeah.
It seems to give a reasonable picture. So why are you so against
gauge
fixing?
Well, I'm not
fixing?
Against. I mean, I used it, I think.
Yeah, but you,
I think
from your story, I got the idea that at low momentum, you don't trust it.
Where what you're looking at is really strong fields, then you know you have to recognize that the fact that you're looking at something which you got from gauge fixing leave some ambiguity in what exactly it's supposed to mean.
It may be gauge fixing.
Here,
maybe gauge
I can probably fairly comfortably believe that this is really quasi-particles out here with k vectors actually given by what the Coulomb gauge fixing is telling me. Here, I think what you really have is you have these strong scrambled fields, where the notion of cage vector may not be terribly meaningful. And in this particular gauge, you get particular answers, but do they really describe appropriately the right kind of physics which is really happening there? I think it's not completely obvious. I'm just being a little defensive.
Well, as long as you get a reasonable curve out of that, that is smooth and it makes sense as a function of k, you have information.
Well, yeah, it's information. It's the answer to a specific question. I'm happy with that. And it has Grybov ambiguities, but I think that they're not...
They seem to be not overwhelming.
Yeah, you live with them. They don't change the answer very much.
Zero temperature imaginary time.
Guy, in this region of small k, we have large occupation numbers.
Yeah.
You would also expect strong color electric fields. Is that right?
Well.
And I was wondering how that would affect.
Sorry, the green is the electric occupancy, and the black is the magnetic.
Okay, so magnetic, you're assuming is bigger.
No, I'm not assuming.
That was something of initial condition. Okay.
No. This is long after initial conditions don't mean anything anymore. This is really some midpoint of some cascade where there's some non-perturbative physics involving these plasma instabilities driving, dumping energy into here, and it's dumping it apparently primarily into magnetic energy.
Okay.
And we see this when we smear the fields, then in this region, when you smear to an amount where this is basically what you're seeing, the magnetic field energy really does dominate the electric field energy.
Okay, because I was just wondering.
And then out here, you really have quasi-particles where the electric and magnetic field energies match each other, which is what you expect.
So I was wondering if I include particle creation effects from strong color electric fields, how that competes with the plasma instability picture.
Well, presumably the particle creation effects are largest for Bose fields because they're occurring mostly in the long wavelength. And so they're explicitly in there. Because the long wavelengths of the Bose fields are part of the simulation. They're in there. Yeah. The creation of fermionic particles is not included. But that particle creation should be dominated by relatively long wavelengths because the electric fields aren't big enough over long enough coherence lengths to give you enough energy to produce a high energy particle. So it should really only be low-energy particles which are getting produced by this electric field acceleration. And then they should be the bosonic ones, and they're in the simulation. So I think that's already included.
Okay, let's discuss it. Okay.
No. In fact, if you look carefully, you'll see a funny little ripple right here.
So this is not thermal.
No, it's not thermal. Yeah, it's going as k to the minus 2 instead of minus 1. This ripple here is the Van Hove singularity from the first place you reach the edge of the Brillouin zone. Okay, which means that from here over, you should not believe anything because you're really seeing the dispersion relation of the lattice. But if that's at 8, then you know that the highest possible k mode on the lattice is at 8 root 3. So this isn't the exact edge of where we have things, but it's getting to where the fact that you're in a periodic block. No, not the periodicity of the box, but the spacing of the box. The periodicity of the Brillouin zone is important. But you should be able to believe the part in here. And we checked that by comparing different lattice spaces, and they were completely consistent, except they didn't have this ripple.